We're learning about how to deal with a narcissistic person and how our culture seems to cultivate these toxic, self-centered, and hostile personalities. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. So celebrities, politicians, perhaps an arrogant CEO, the fact is we all have a bit of narcissist in us, but not everyone should be called one. Do you think Americans are by nature a little narcissistic? What about our national character? Do you think the media feeds a narcissistic society? Join in the conversation at any point this hour. We're at 800-642-1234. Lori Helgo is a clinical psychologist. She's an associate professor of behavioral sciences at Ross University School of Medicine in Barbados. And her new book is called Fragile Bully: Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump. Lori, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for having me.
So you see narcissism on this spectrum and that we can't throw all narcissists onto the same, broad brush strokes. So how would you define it?
Yes, exactly. Narcissism exists on a continuum, and at its base, it's simply self-interest. So if we have no narcissism, that's a problem. And if we have too much of it, that's a problem. And on the far extreme end of it, we have something called narcissistic personality disorder, which includes, as the DSM, our diagnostic manual says, a pervasive pattern of grandiosity, need for admiration, and a lack of empathy. So at that extreme, it becomes problematic. There's not really room for anyone else.
But there's all this middle ground, middle area, and your book title, Fragile Bully, you use the phrase to describe narcissists. So can you break that down for us? What is a fragile bully and how does that fit into the spectrum?
Yeah, so fragile bully, I think, is a more descriptive term for what we call a narcissist. Because there are two poles to narcissism, and we recognize the one, the grandiosity, the bully, the one who needs to always be in the spotlight, maybe pushes other people out of the way to do that. On the other hand, there's this fragility, and we know, that a self that's based on bullying is probably not inherently strong. But beyond that, this neediness is something that we maybe sense, but we don't often label, that there is this sense that really we need to take care of the narcissist and kind of keep that person in the spotlight or they will fall apart. And then there are varying degrees within narcissists in terms of whether the bully side is stronger or the fragile side is stronger. But that dynamic, I think, is what makes it so perplexing.
How do fragile bullies do with criticism?
Not well. And in fact, on the vulnerable end of the spectrum, that's where we may really see, the pathology come out. You might even just say to that person, I could use a little more help with this. And that is experienced as an injury because you're saying that that person is not perfect. And so the person may then become very defensive and, fall apart and kind of manipulate you to affirming them and kind of restoring their sense of self.
We're talking about narcissism with your stories, your questions along the way. Lori Helgo is a clinical psychologist, and her new book is called Fragile Bully: Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump. Have you noticed narcissistic behaviors in yourself or others around you? What questions do you have about those encounters, those experiences? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Lori, the title of your book has Trump. You've said that President Trump's relationship with the public, specifically the media, that's an example, you say, of the fragile bully. Can you explain the connection there? What is going on?
Yes, sure, I can. And just to make it clear, I'm not in the position to diagnose the president. I have not interviewed him. I do not know him. what I know is kind of the public presentations and the interactions that characterize narcissism. And an example of that is the president makes a very provocative statement, maybe puts someone down. And the response, the natural response to that can be, okay, I want to put this person in their place, especially if you're an opponent, a political opponent. So then the media, the opponents react kind of in kind. And so that there's this retaliatory kind of putting in his place, belittling, drawing attention to perhaps, the most embarrassing side of what he might have said. And then there's the fragility comes out and the feeling victimized. And then what that does is it keeps the focus on him. And when I say him, I think we can talk about that pretty broadly, because it becomes like a virus where we all are vying then for this kind of to win, this argument of who's going to be visible, who's going to, come through as the right one.
I wonder if you see how this unfolds on Twitter.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Twitter is just the perfect vehicle for narcissistic interactions, because you don't have much time. And really the essence of narcissism or narcissistic disorders is that they're dehumanizing. They not only, I think a narcissist, and I'm talking about the extreme end of the continuum, dehumanizes him or herself. They put forward this grandiose version of themselves that they've identified with to kind of hold themselves up. And we could talk about the development of that, but that's what gets seen. And then there's a dehumanizing response to that. And we see that all over social media and Twitter, where you find people who normally would be quite pleasant, perhaps, becoming very toxic and triggered in these interactions.
Would you think that narcissism in some ways is American, is part of our fabric, our identity?
I'll, there's actually research to suggest that is the way we are regarded and the way we regard ourselves. A survey of Americans plus representatives of a number of other countries, Turkey, China, Spain, UK, found that Americans tended to see Americans, interestingly, as more narcissistic than themselves, but generally narcissistic. And people from other countries tended to see Americans as more narcissistic than people from their own countries. So there is that perception. And we become kind of the entertainment source, I think, for the world to some extent, and very much like a narcissist. We both provide that kind of dazzle and feed people's curiosity, and also then kind of consume the space.
The book is called Fragile Bully. Author and clinical psychologist Lori Helgo is our guide. Do you think narcissism is part of our nation's fabric? If so, how did we get here? How do you think obsessions with celebrity culture or reality TV affect us? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here on a Friday. We're looking at the complexities of narcissism, where we see it, how to deal with it, why it's fueled here in the U.S. In the months leading up to the 2016 presidential campaign, psychologist Lori Helgo grew concerned about strong feelings dividing Americans. Do you think Americans are by nature a little narcissistic? What about our national character? What about world leaders? Do you think running for president is a little narcissistic? Join in at 800-642-1234. The book is called Fragile Bully: Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump. And Lori Helgo stays with us through the hour. So, Lori, you now live on the island nation of Barbados, about 300 miles northeast of Venezuela. What have you noticed about the national character there and how it's different than in the U.S.?
Yes, this has been a fascinating ride for me. I've only been living here since mid-December, but what I noticed, and I think helps us understand the continuum of narcissism, is that sense of entitlement that we see as a very kind of American trait. People do not have a problem advocating for themselves. If customer service is bad, we complain. And we have the capacity to advocate for ourselves, which can be, you know, can means we get better service, we get better treatment. On the other hand, there is a way that coming to Barbados made me realize how kind of burdensome that is, this idea that we have to get things exactly as we want, when exactly we want them. And actually for a while, because my school was actually displaced from Dominica after the hurricane, and we operated on a ship for a while in St. Kitts. And I remember coming home from St. Kitts, and there was every possible delay you could imagine. Everything went wrong. You know, being sequestered to have, you know, our status checked, to having our actual reservations lost, everything. And I found myself aware that I just had the expectation that things take time. It's island time. And I was just observing myself not getting anxious about it. And we did make the flight. Everything worked out. I got to the U.S. and I don't know what it was about crossing the border, but we're in Miami and it should be warmer, right? It was, you know, but it was cold and it was late. And I don't know what minor problems we faced there, but I was harumphing about it. And just, again, observing myself that what was it about being here that, you know, my expectations for things to be perfect changed. And so I think I've learned a lot from that, you know, that contrast.
Wow. Let's take a call now. Lori joining us in Madison. Hi, Lori.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What I have found is I'm in my early 50s, and in the last couple of years, after ending a relationship that ended bad, and I went to my counselor, and the first word she said is, well, he was a narcissist. I'm like, well, what is that? And things started putting together that my grandfather was, my father was, his brothers, my uncles, my own brother. And I just kept seeing like a pattern. And then when I became an adult, the men that I would date in general, my ex-husband, they were all narcissists too. And it took a lot of counseling in the last couple of years to learn about narcissists and also why I was attracted to that behavior, which doesn't make sense. I'm a strong, I think a strong, independent woman, but I kept falling down that hole. And also just talking to my cousins about how their fathers, my uncles, were the same boat, how they treated people and the same behavior. And it's been really interesting.
Lori, how is your life today?
Peaceful. It's my father a couple years ago died of cancer, but in this happened about a year after I realized, you know, find out more about narcissists, and maybe more powerful when he was even trying to bully me on his deathbed. And, you know, I saw my mom hover, but and my sister, but not me. And it took a long time. It took a lot of counseling. And I think it's something that for some people, maybe it's just ingrown. I mean, I think it was with my family on the male side.
Lori Helgo, what do you hear in Lori and Madison's story?
Laurie and Madison, I identify with a lot of what you're saying, and struggled myself with a narcissistic father and who I was very attached to, and so there's that, both of those things, and it's very, there's something that Freud talked about called repetition compulsion, and the idea is not that we repeat patterns because we're masochists. We repeat patterns as a way to try to master, as a way to try to heal, as a way to try to work things out. And unfortunately, sometimes, you know, there's along the way the pain of of suffering more. But sometimes it is that suffering that finally, you know, pushes us to get the kind of help that you did. But yes, there are a number of ways that we get hooked by narcissists. And if it's familiar, you know, it's like familiar music. We want to hear it again. There is something we can be drawn to.
I wonder, is there perhaps a genetic link, or why would Lori be attracted to these type of behaviors that had been around her in her family?
Right. So one thing that I picked up on is that Lori said that she's a very strong woman. So it seems, you know, kind of counterintuitive that she might be drawn to, you know, people who would bully her. And one of the, I talk about different dances that we can engage with around with a narcissist. Through. And one is the superior dance. And it is this, it's often therapists, often very strong emotionally people that get hooked into this dance. And that is the one where, you know, if I'm understanding enough, we get sometimes hooked by the fragility we pick up on. If I, you know, or if I am strong enough, even I can get through to this person. I can, because I, you know, have it together more than this person. The problem with that is we then neglect ourselves. We kind of give over and we deny our own vulnerability. So that is one of the hooks that can be very invisible, because it seems that we kind of know what's going on. We know what we're doing.
Can you ever pull away from a narcissist fully? I mean, even on her father's deathbed, there was that bullying going on.
You know, that makes me think of the myth of Narcissus. It's very powerful image, because in the myth of Narcissus, even after his death, he goes to Hades and he finds a pool to look in there. So the pervasiveness of those patterns are something that we have to contend with. At more moderate levels of narcissism, there often is a way that you can, and in fact, with my own father, I was able to do some painful interactions to actually have him see me and to work things through. But often, as Lori found, the only winning move is to not play. I'm quoting from the movie War Games. Thermonuclear war, you know, we can't win that game. So sometimes the only winning move is to stop playing, stop trying.
Talking with Lori Helgo, she's a clinical psychologist and the author of Fragile Bully, Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump. Do you think running for president is a little narcissistic? Do you see a difference between Americans and people from other cultures? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Lori, what about American leaders? You know, thinking about this topic, there was this 2013 study that ranked the presidents by their grandiose narcissism and found that on average, presidents are more narcissistic than typical Americans. What do you make of that?
Well, for one thing, it's quite intuitive that to want to be president, to want to be in the public eye, to have that much power, there has to be, you know, some level of narcissism. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, moderate degrees of narcissism are correlated, and this study found, with good crisis management, the ability to rally people to your cause, to initiate legislation, to win the vote, you know. On the other hand, at the pathological levels, there is a relationship between unethical behaviors and narcissism. And, you know, the kind of impeachment resolutions have been found to be related to narcissistic qualities. So what that means is, I think when the narcissism is that extreme, that person is willing to compromise their ethics in order to perhaps look right or get the kind of regard that they need.
We're looking at the spectrum of narcissism, the person who has a pattern of grandiosity, need for admiration, lack of empathy. The book is called Fragile Bully. And in her writing, clinical psychologist Lori Helgo explores this spectrum of narcissists. Have you noticed self-centered behaviors in yourself or others close to you? What questions do you have about that experience? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the healthy and unhealthy traits of narcissism. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Psychologist Lori Helgo says we use the term narcissist a lot today, and it's better to see it on a spectrum. Do you encounter people who have an inflated sense of self? Are they hostile in trying to turn their manipulative behaviors toward you? How do you react in those situations? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. The book is called Fragile Bully, Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump, and author Lori Helgo stays with us. Lori, we have an email here from Ryan in Sparta, and Ryan says, I had a supervisor who was a narcissist. The workplace environment became intolerable. And for the coworkers, Ryan said that Ryan left behind, that they're still dealing with this person. They're still struggling. Ryan asks, do you have any suggestions for dealing with a narcissistic supervisor or coworker?
Yes, and this is very tricky. What can happen often is that the very provocations of a narcissistic coworker or supervisor pull things from you that then put you in a vulnerable position. So pull reactions from you, as I've talked about. So the first rule of thumb is to not bite the bait. And that can be hard, you know, but to document instead of reacting. There can be circumstances, and again, in the moderate land of this area of the spectrum, where you actually can bring yourself into the room and have a more civil conversation. And I think of that with an interaction that I had with a coworker in a meeting who was kind of taking his time. I was trying to manage time in the meeting, but kind of going off storytelling, and I would try to bring us back. And then he said, you interrupted me. And so, and this happened more than once. And afterwards, in front of colleagues, he kind of blasted me for, you know, you interrupted me more than once. And I just had a very heavy look on my face, which was very authentic. And I said, you know, I really wish you had tried to run this meeting, because it was very hard to try to contain the time boundaries. And I just brought myself and my experience into the room without retaliating about his perception and defending what I did. He came back to me later and apologized, which blew me away, because this is not a person who does that. Now, this is not always going to be effective, but I think Craig Malkin talks a lot about using empathy prompts, where we not prompt. What that means is we prompt others to be to empathize with us. Every narcissistic maneuver, and I don't say that they're necessarily trying to maneuver. A lot of these are unconscious, but every narcissistic maneuver draws attention back and focus back to the narcissist. Whether you're retaliating, whether you're fixing, whether you're feel guilty and trying to repair something. So to counter that, we really need to maintain a focus on what it is we need, what we are about, and whether we do and how we do that, we may need to be strategic about in a work environment.
And maintaining, just an awareness of how we're feeling or perhaps being drawn into that manipulative behavior, which is really hard to see in the moment.
Absolutely. It's very hard. And the joke I had when I was early practicing and I became interested in working with personality disorders, we would note that it was often our first severe personality disorder that sent us into our own therapy. and that's not at all a bad thing, because we really do have to be very self-aware when dealing with people with these kinds of disorders. The problem is that with certain psychological disorders, we call them autoplastic disorders, like anxiety and depression, it's the person who's, with the disorder is suffering, and they feel it. They reach out for help. With personality disorders, it's often the people around them, their alloplastic disorders, that the problem is projected into the relationships and the world around them. So we often carry their disorders, which isn't fair, but it does offer an opportunity for us to really get clear on where our hooks are.
We're talking about narcissism with your stories, your questions along the way. Lori Helgo is a clinical psychologist and author of the new book, Fragile Bully. Have you noticed narcissistic behaviors in yourself, others around you? What questions do you have? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Scott now, joining us from Manitouish Waters. Hi, Scott.
Yes, good morning. I wonder, you seem to be kind of tap dancing around it a little bit, but our president is the absolute poster boy for this this narcissistic type of behavior. Everything from demanding loyalty or you're fired. That episode where he had his cabinet, each one had to say something nice about him. The way he attacks people. He's the absolute poster boy of this, and I don't know if he's turning our country into that type of country, but he is it. He is it.
Lori, what do you make of that, what Scott's saying?
Yes, and I think this is challenging territory, and he's probably right that I'm tap dancing to some degree, because ethically, I'm not in a position where I can make statements about a public figure's mental health. We have something called the Goldwater Rule, and it's an important rule because it's too easy to get our political agendas mixed up and to then use our diagnostic, expertise. Besides the fact that I literally cannot diagnose somebody who I've not evaluated. So there's that. There's also the fact that what we see what's communicated to us. And unfortunately, what's compelling is often the most apparent, important part of the picture. That said, yes, there are these bullying behaviors. Absolutely, we see them. There are these provocations. There is the retaliatory, focus. Here's the challenge, is that by diagnosing, by focusing on that, by characterizing him as a narcissist, we're doing exactly the thing that we're trying to get away from. We keep him in the spotlight. We keep the focus on this, and we don't address what we really need to be addressing. The other part of that, and this happens with our reactions to people in narcissistic leanings or loadings to a large degree, is that we want to make them small. And that's a dangerous game, because when we do that, they become bigger. And so what in dealing with, and this may be the same with dealing with a narcissist boss, we have to acknowledge the power that these people hold. And and even, you may cringe, caller, even respect that, because when we do that, we are better able to hold the person accountable than when we belittle the person. So I'm not saying that we don't, use our channels to combat whatever we think is wrong or whatever we disagree with. But the belittling route is a slippery slope into just reinforcing.
Scott, thanks for the call. Let's go to Angela now in Wausau. Angela, hi.
Hi. My question is more of an observation. I'm just wondering how much of a crutch calling someone else in our lives a narcissist has become. Honestly, every divorce friend I've had for the last 10 years, the other side was a narcissist. Is there an epidemic, or, you know, it just seems like overly prevalent now. And I just wonder why, and is that an easy way for us not to hold our own selves accountable?
Aha. Angela, thank you.
Brilliant comment. And thank you so much for that, because, yes, we have weaponized the term to, a historical high, I think. Yes. And it is a very easy way to get ourselves off the hook. And when I say hook, I mean that, because my whole centerpiece of my book is that this is not a solo dance. We engage, and partly what hooks us is our own narcissism. Is that, wait a minute, this person is getting too much attention, I need more. It's not to dismiss the fact that there are people that have a very toxic presence and really can do some damage. But when we look at the statistics, they are a very small portion of the population, like 1%. It's very hard. Some studies can't find a narcissist in their study group. Okay, so I mean, what I mean by that is narcissistic personality disorder. So yes, it's probably not true that every person who gets divorced had a narcissist or somebody with narcissistic personality disorder in their sphere.
But it's an easy term to use to have the other person kind of know where you're coming from.
Right, it's a shorthand.
Shorthand.
Yes, mm-hmm. It is shorthand. And the problem is that there's just so many nuances that get overlooked when we use that shorthand. Because, yes, there are narcissistic patterns for sure.
We're looking at narcissism that some self-interest is healthy, but it manifests in different ways as we're learning. It can go too far on a spectrum and become unhealthy. That vulnerability becomes a manipulative behavior. And then the fragile bully emerges, which is the name of the book by Lori Helgo. And she stays with us. Still time for your questions, your thoughts on narcissism. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're getting a better understanding of narcissistic behaviors. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So tracing back the history of the word to Greek mythology, a beautiful young man named Narcissus refuses the attention of a female spirit named Echo. And instead, Narcissus falls in love with the image of himself reflected back at him in the water. So now leap forward from Greek mythology all the way to today, where we see tribalism, we see social media rants, and we see this culture in America that seems to encourage individualism. Where do you see narcissistic tendencies in your life? How do you deal with them? Join in 800-642-1234. Psychologist Lori Helgo's book is called Fragile Bully, and she stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Reed joining us from Portage. Hi, Reed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My concern is that Dr. Helgo, well-meaning as she is blurring the concept of narcissism with self-confidence and selfishness and self-importance and so on. And one other thing because she includes our current president in her title. She's missing the fact that true narcissism has to do with self-love, and nobody better exemplifies that than a president who writes two autobiographical works before he's even president, and that, of course, is Mr. Obama.
Reed, and I want to ask this to Lori as well, but when you say self-love, what do you mean by that, and can it go too far?
It certainly can, but I think that in calling everything that has to do with self-confidence and self-interest, narcissism is a mistake. It's misconceptualizing the real meaning of narcissism.
Lori, what do you hear?
Right, and thank you for raising that, because I think it can be a confusing spectrum. And self-love, true self-love, and Narcissus, the myth of Narcissus really helps us understand that true self-love is really inhabiting ourselves. So Narcissus is caught in the reflection. He can't get away from it. And he's actually been cursed to fall in love with himself. But that kind of love is someone who doesn't really possess themselves. They don't have a self they can carry around and then interact and listen and kind of forget about, right? He's always needing to focus on it. And so what happens to him? He starves. And this is the tragedy of Narcissus, is that he loses human connection. It's like an addiction. He actually is not able to get the sustenance he needs. So that is not really self-love. It's a different kind. It's a self-possession. It's a self-obsession, I should say. Not a self-possession, a self-obsession.
Before we run out of time here, I want to look at celebrity culture for a moment. You use the ABC shows The Bachelor and The Bachelorette as a pop culture example of this fascination with narcissism. Can you explain what celebrity culture is in terms of this narcissistic behavior and what we see through the media lens?
Yeah, so I think reality TV is a really good example of what is both compelling and repellent about pathological narcissism. I actually interviewed a young woman who was on a reality TV program that was rather short-lived, but it was set in West Virginia. And she talked about how the editing worked to kind of draw attention to kind of create villains, for example, to create spectacle, and also the way in which then becoming a reality TV star fed this narcissistic need. There's actually been research that people who watch reality TV, who prefer it or prefer a lot of political shows, tend to have a little higher level of narcissism. So there is also that part of it. But we're compelled by the entertainment value. We're actually compelled by how angry these shows can make us. Mm-hmm. Even there are actually some brain mechanisms that get activated when we want revenge. We have to be aware of that helps, because we may need to go through some withdrawal if we find that we're really getting pulled in. Because like Narcissus, we may end up starving ourselves. We may actually not be getting good nutrition.
Lori, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate. I've enjoyed it.
Lori Helgo's new book is called Fragile Bully, Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump. She's an associate professor of behavioral sciences at Ross University School of Medicine in Barbados. The Great Lakes have had a record-breaking summer. Lakes Erie and Ontario are seeing the highest water levels ever recorded. And Lake Superior remains high for this time of year. Danielle Kading recently caught up with lakefront property owners there who are dealing with the encroaching water. Theron O'Connor stands on the shoreline of his lakefront property, just a few miles outside Cornucopia. He and his family have been coming to his grandfather's cabin since they were kids.
It was built by a Swedish immigrant, Charlie Saxeen, and he built the cabin, hand-hewn, two-story log, rectangular building. And then my grandfather kind of added on to it.
O'Connor, who lives in Bayfield, says it's a place they all come back to for a couple weeks a year. But the cabin just beyond the bank may not be where it is now if high water levels and storms continue to pound the shoreline. There's little or no beach, and trees lean toward the water. O'Connor says they cut some down to keep them from tearing away the hillside.
The land is so saturated that it won't really hold. This is basically clay with a little bit of sandy loam on top of it. And that got absolutely saturated, both from the heavy rains and snows of the last 2 years.
If erosion continues to creep closer, O'Connor says they may have to move his grandfather's cabin back several hundred feet from the shore. Even if lake levels go down, his wife, Damaris Brinton, says that won't stop the rain.
That water comes down like somebody has turned over Lake Superior on top of us. You know, it's a remarkable amount of water coming down at once.
So you want to wander...
Sure, yeah.
We should go down toward Ken's house.
Ken Prey and his family own property next to O'Connor, just through the woods. He points to huge rifts in the soil slumping downward and a tree where a hammock had been tied. Now it stands in two pieces, several feet apart, split down the middle from erosion.
The other end of the hammock is on the hook on that tree. But that thing used to be right here.
Prey thinks the erosion would be much worse if not for all the trees lining the hillside.
I think typically a lot of people would say, well, I want a nice view of that point, so let's move, get those trees out of there. And that's then where you get in trouble, because it's only the roots. That's all you got.
Bayfield County Zoning Director Rob Shearman says proper land management is a constant battle with lakefront property owners.
If you're going to be cutting down all the vegetation so that you can see the lake, like you're looking at a picture, you can expect to have problems with erosion in your structure might not last as long as you want it to.
Shearman says several cabins or homes are moved back from the shoreline in Bayfield County each year. High water levels and storms have only made the problem worse, resulting in millions of dollars in damage across the Great Lakes. Some are blaming the International Joint Commission, which oversees water flows. But Chief Hydrologist Keith Kompoltowicz with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says the ability to control outflows doesn't mean you can control lake levels.
It's a matter of scale, to be quite honest with you. Lake Superior is extremely large, and the variability in the rainfall, runoff, and evaporation that falls on Lake Superior is much greater than the ability to increase or decrease outflow.
Record high levels on the Great Lakes come on the heels of record low water levels, according to Drew Gronewald. He's associate professor with the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability. Gronewald says they're exploring whether increased rain and snowfall, along with high water temperatures and evaporation, are normal or the result of climate change.
So what we're trying to understand better is, to what extent is this amplification of those extremes leading to swings in water levels from one extreme to the other?
Gronewald says it's hard to predict what lake levels will look like over the long term. Lakefront property owners like O'Connor hope they'll fall sooner rather than later.
It could be that this will kind of heal up again and go back and be stable terrain again.
Until then, he says they're pulling together construction details in case they have to move back from the shoreline. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.